Rolling.
I came here on a golden rocket.
You never listen to me.
Leaving on a magic carpet and now.
Divorce sucks.
It's what you do this time.
We don't like each other.
He doesn't like me. I like him.
I'm Serge.
I'm Monica.
We were married for almost 9 years. We're divorced now.
We live four doors down from each other.
We have three kids.
You're not being very nice to me.
This is our story of divorce and life after divorce. Our ex-life.
Our ex-life.
I want a drink too.
Because I can edit anything out. You feel you're like you still treat it like you're a musician, and you're like once you hit record, you have to do the thing.
I'm on.
No, editing is magic that way. Where?
It's fake.
Editing's not fake. You feel like you have to do a clean take. Like once we're recording, that's it. It's over. I can't. When I go into edit it, just chop off the beginning, where you're an asshole or whatever.
But then no one will ever hear the true conversation.
They're hearing the true conversation from the point that... All right, whatever.
Can I show you something?
I guess so. I mean...
I thought this is a cool way to start off the
show. Are we starting already?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is us starting.
We're starting. I saw that. It is a picture of our family. And there is you and me and Henry and Violet. Oh my God, that's Violet's actual shirt that says love, love, love.
Henry drew this over the course of a couple days.
Look at Charlie.
That's my jacket. He made me stand in front of him posing in my winter jacket because that's what I wear even in the house.
Oh, your black jacket, yeah. Oh my God, I love this. That's our family.
I thought it was a good way to start.
Well, it's a nice tribute where you have a kid that draws a photo of their family and he comes from two homes of divorced parents, and it's just our family together. Yeah. Nice. Good work, Henry. Good work. Hello. Hi, I'm me. My name is Monica.
How are you doing this week?
Who, me?
Yeah.
I'm here. It's funny. I was thinking, here's what I was thinking as I drove here to do this with you, was... Setting out to have this podcast conversation with you is a little like a real world interaction with divorced people where, you know, when you like, whether you meet up with your ex for whatever circumstance to exchange the kids or talk about whatever, you kind of never know what vibe it's going to be. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you jive and it's great and you're laughing, and other times you're irritable with each other, or one time one person is great and the other person's sad. You just don't know what vibe to expect until the actual exchange starts happening.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how this podcast goes for me, where I don't know if you're going to irritate me or we're going to have a great vibe or you're going to be making me laugh or I'm going to be annoyed or sad until the conversation starts. And here the conversation is happening and the vibe is developing and I don't know.
Maybe you should have drank a beer before you came over.
That's great, Serge. Let everyone know I'm an alcoholic right off the bat.
I didn't say that. You did.
I do drink a lot of beer.
You're like Hank Jr. in the late 70s.
That's right. I don't care.
So we wanted to talk about this whole concept, not concept, but the idea of one adult, three kids, which is
right.
a huge part of our lives now.
When you get a divorce, you... If you're like most people, you split custody in some fashion or the other, whether it's they're always with one person and then spend a chunk of time with the other person, or it's like Serge and me where we go back and forth. Whatever the case is, there's going to be one parent alone with the children. And that is just a super mind fuck, really. It's I think the most difficult part of divorce for me has been... That, whether it's learning to be without your kids or being alone with all of the kids.
Yeah. Do you know where I feel judgy sometimes? Like, I don't see myself as a very judgmental person. I could be.
I don't think
because I
are.
Hate everyone, but but sometimes I feel judgy when I hear about stories where a parent in a divorce or a separation, it doesn't have to be a divorce because perhaps there was no marriage involved, you know?
Right.
But when one parent sort of elects willingly to have the kids less, is that wrong for me to think that way? Like to say, to maybe, I don't want to say I look down on them, but it freaks me out so much to even, because naturally I then put myself in that position, like, in what way could I have ever come up with?
No, I don't
want to be with them half
the time. That's a really good question, because I've heard of a lot of divorces. I mean, it happens all the time where a parent moves out of state, and that parent, for whatever reason, including my own dad who moved out of state, and that parent has custody, like, what is it? I think it's a court ordered, like, 6 weeks in the summer or whatever it is. And then they alternate Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's sort of how the custody situation works in those cases.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I cannot fathom it. I don't understand it. And I haven't admitted, as do you, chip on your shoulder about those kinds of circumstances, because both of our dads divorced our parents or our moms and left the state. And your dad wasn't involved at all. Mm-hmm. And my dad was not very involved either. And there wasn't even a 6 week custody period. It was this very haphazard arrangement. And it really kind of killed a little piece of me that my dad didn't choose to stay closer. And they
a little piece? Come on.
Right.
You know, that was like the JFK assassination,
right,
of childhood
and
little
and
pieces.
You can explain it away in any way you want, where I had to move for a job or this or that, but there is no fucking way. I don't care about a job or a this or a love situation where you fall in love with someone else. There is no fucking way I am ever leaving my kid, period. So
no.
I get the judgment.
No. Right. Okay. And so you mentioning our particular situations, our childhoods, and with absent fathers or largely absent fathers who, I mean, with my dad, it was a choice. You know, he chose to live the life that he ended up living.
Well, every dad, it's a choice, is it not? Like,
well,
when is
well,
it not
when
a choice?
When you say, you know, you mentioned courts and judges
too.
And things
okay,
like that.
Right.
So that changes everything. But it does then bring me back to my original question to you right now, starting this conversation, in, like, when a parent chooses, like, does that happen a lot? I guess it does, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I hadn't even thought of my own situation, but now that you mentioned it, yeah. Like, there was no court order for my dad.
He just left with his girlfriend.
Right. He didn't have anything right. to say or argue
same
in a court or anything. He just left.
Same with my dad. He got a job. So he always sort of justified it in retrospect as I had to get a job. But he could have got a job in Utah instead of moving to New Mexico and Colorado. He could have stuck it out and got a job. So in a way, they're all choosing to leave. Who's when it, you tell me the circumstance when a parent is forced away.
Right. And again, like, as I'm older now,
my point is I understand your judgment.
Right. And I'm trying not to be judgmental.
I'm interested if someone out there has a situation that they can contact us with and say, you know, I had to leave and
right.
here's why.
And I'm sure there are.
And I
there
did
must
not want
be.
To.
There has to be.
Right.
But I suppose in a larger frame, I'm wondering how people do that, like how they can do it. Not even if they don't want to. They do it even though it wasn't, like, court mandated.
The only thing I can think of is tough financial times and somebody was looking for a job forever to help support their kids and they couldn't find one and then one opened up in another state and they didn't want to mess with their kids in school.
I think there's a lot more reasons than that. I think demons play a large role in that often.
What do you mean? Leaving?
Drugs, alcohol.
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think lots of parents.
Oh, just leaving.
Yeah, just split because they have some monkey on their back.
I'm not talking about deadbeat parents. I'm talking about, is there a scenario where a loving parent was forced to leave and did not want to?
Well, then that brings us to the larger question, which is probably a whole other episode, but what is a deadbeat parent? You know, if... Is it just a matter of paying support? No, it's much more than that. Much, much, much more than that.
Well, all right.
Right?
So
don't even try and argue with me.
I'm not even arguing with you. You're arguing with yourself, I think. I don't even know.
That's the problem here.
Well.
So you and I, right, from the get-go, even in what I would still deem the worst period of my life, when we decided that, or you decided that the separation is happening, you were pregnant with Charlie, our third child, our second son, and we broke up. And from that moment on,
it wasn't certain. We didn't break up. I said I needed some space. Can you give me some space? It wasn't a done deal. I wasn't like, get the hell out, we're done. I was like,
you said some things that made it sound kind of done.
You had
a done tone.
A done tone.
And plus the look in your eyes was like, I'm out.
But it was really scary, and I didn't want to be done. Right. I was having our third child. It just felt like this only option for survival. And then, you know, we had him, and you did move back home. You were staying at your mom's, and then you moved back home for a little bit to be with Charlie and the whole family after he was born, and it just fizzled very quickly. It didn't feel right.
Right. But that aside, we did land on one thing that we were both sure of, and that was we never want to deny the other person
no
time with our kids.
No, it's just that
it was a no-brainer.
No, of course.
I don't know what all, like, looking back on it, I suppose everything comes into play in your mind, you know, survival from the financial angle, survival from the emotional and psychological angle, all of it. And it was, my God, it was by far the most overwhelming, scary thing that we've ever been through, looking down the barrel of, you know, we're about to have or we've just had an infant and we're doing this. It seems like this is happening. And yet we've stuck to that. And we
stuck
find
to what?
Ourselves...
Equal time with the kids,
yeah.
Really? Well, here's what I don't get. And that brings up a whole other point where maybe I get judgy with other people is I don't understand, unless a parent has a drug problem or an alcohol problem where you're actually worried for the kid's safety, if you yourself are a good parent, you would never argue over custody because you know the other parent is equally important to your kids. So when I hear of these couples with custody debates over who's going to have the kids more or whatever, I don't understand that because I know you're a good parent and I know that to be a good mom, I need to provide equal access to you for my kids. Why would I ever argue for my kids not to see their dad? That makes no sense to me.
You learn crying when you fall. You learn earthworm when you're fishing. You set the hook upon the jaw. You learn rats when
you're that bass I saw at Poe Valley, that big one by the dock. Remember I told you it was orange and white?
Yeah.
It really was.
The bass?
Yeah.
Orange and white, like a creamsicle.
I am not lying. I saw it went in the weeds and came out, in the weeds and came out. I went for one of my worms, but then I fell in and it just went back in.
It sounds like a carp. Like it might have been a carp, which is possible in that.
Carp can be orange and white.
You learn rats when you're resting. You learn praying when you're alone. Learn to love your hometown when you're traveling. Learn to love the highway when you're home. Learn to love the highway when you're traveling. Learn to love your hometown when you're home.
We fish for fish that are small and weak. Henry and me are both massive by comparison. He's 6 and scrawny, which makes me even more of a force. Look at me, though, standing there on the lake, squinting at the gilded ripples dancing in the sun. I'm a Western Eastwood, a Terminator. I'm glaring at a 7-inch largemouth bass flapping around on my hook, high above the water where she lives. She's probably scared out of her mind. Her vision must be all blurry, memories bashing through her wild mind the way that they do when your Subaru is flipping out on the interstate and you're dead soon. Airbag technology be damned.
because your face is about to meet with the curvy top part of a guardrail that, up till now, has remained the most anonymous stretch of metal on Earth, but which is about to slice you into the darkness. You got one, Dad? Henry hollers at me from his spot down by the wooden bench. We're at the little boat launch area. It's become our spot this summer. Sometimes he doesn't want to come here. He wants to try somewhere else. But screw that. I'm a creature of habit. I want to squeeze as much simple joy out of this ride as possible. We catch fish here, and even if they're hardly ever big ones, who cares, right? Who cares what we catch? Who cares what we do? We are out here in the sunshine, moving slower because maybe our blood has happiness in it. I don't know where that comes from. I don't get happiness. Is it real? Is it a chemical released from your brain, or from pizza, or wine, or sex, from meth? Is it always so temporary, or has anyone ever had a happiness that lasted? Like, they woke up one day and all their shit was in place, all the ducks lined up. And even though they knew it would fade, the smile lighting up their puss would go out after an hour or two, when the next bill came, or when their husband or wife came home from work, and they were drugged back into the inexplicable darkness that came over them every time this person they once loved, still love, appeared in the kitchen. Appearing again, never looking them in the eye anymore, beating them down, beating them back with their own unhappiness. One of their pubes on the toilet seat making you ill, making you furious. How is this my life? Motherfucking happiness thief, working, driving together to the Target with the kids in the back. A family listening to Arcade Fire because you're both trying to remain in light. Everyone up front bluer than the October sky. Everyone in the back happy with their goldfish in a Ziploc. Until they're tired, bored, and they collapse, utterly dejected by life, in the shoe aisle in a half hour, unhappiness oozing up out of them like street vent steam. It never went away, the happy. It remained. I doubt that has ever happened. How could it work? Largemouth, I yell at Henry. He's running my way now. He drops his rod to the ground over where he is. He don't give a rat's ass. He lets it fall out of his hand like a cigarette he's done with, and he runs at me with everything in his body. Dad, I want to throw it back in. He wants to throw it back in, you see. Six, young, beautiful, sharp, happy, sad, fiery, sweet. My middle child, my first boy, my first son. He wants to throw it back in, this little bass. Why? I don't know. I don't ask him, and he wouldn't know what to say even if I did. He'd probably look up at me with brown eyeballs that speak beyond his heart or mind. Seriously, Dad? You really need to ask me that? What do you think? Why are we even here? I want to throw it back in because I want to feel wet fish skin on my kid's skin. I want to feel connected to something. I want to touch a thing, a totally wild and free thing for a brief moment, for like 3 seconds while we hold it captive before I give it back to life, okay? Does that make sense, dipshit? Henry moves into the fish's head and whispers. Sorry. Then he raises it to his lips and watches to see if I'm looking, and I am, and so he kisses its top lip with his lips. He doesn't fake the kiss. He's truly happy. It's a real smooch. You can't fake that stuff. Not when you're standing there in the world, unencumbered by demons or ghosts or lust or whatever. He's overjoyed right now, and it's truer than God or money. He might be the only human being alive on the planet at this moment who's feeling the purity. I'd lie to you and say I'm with him if I was a lying man, because I'm feeling something, don't get me wrong. I'm all climbed up in Henry's smile, and it's propelling me upwards in ways both rare and strange to me anymore. I'm an American adult. I walk around in a haze of poisonous anxiety. My dreams embarrass me. Sometimes I'm ashamed to want to live the life I live. Writer, rock and roll guitar player, broke, scared. Serves you damn right, you banged up daydreaming sack of hot piss. Then sometimes I watch Henry kiss a fish and something in me clicks. All of this is because of all of that. All of us is because of everything that happened. My choices, diving in so fast and hard, rash, no plan, young, then youngish. I turned away from so much. I wanted to be happy. I wanted to live a happy life. I swore I knew how. Sometimes I think I still do. Henry tosses the bass back into the water. It slaps down over near the cattails that will steal your hook if you think you're a fishing badass and can cast anywhere near them. I'm cranked up on coffee, got my last kicks in just under the 4 p.m. window on our way here. I sucked it down on the ride over the mountain. Sometimes we see deer. Not today, though. By the time we got to the lake, I was twitchy, unable to achieve full happiness because my veins were pulsating with this artificial kind to keep me from feeling comfortable enough to touch any kind of honest vibe. the closest I can come is this. Me and my son watched the spreading circles of a very small fish that ate one of the worms we bought at the gas station like 2 weeks ago. I keep them in the fridge in that little Japanese hotel room butter section thing up on the door until we break them out for a day like today is turning out to be. Even if neither of us know it right now, since a ton of the happiness that will someday come from these fleeting moments, the two of us being alive together and standing together, is currently racing away from us. Up, 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 through the puff clouds and the bluebird sky, slitting through all that, bursting out into the blackness of space. Out past the moon, out past the sun, me and Henry in the ripples of a long-gone baby bass shattering out into the stars. So swift we are now, only turning back around when we're older, when happiness is harder for both of us probably, because life will eventually whittle away at the childish toothpick castle he was born in. So much will happen, his heart will break so bad, his soul will try to punch his face from the backside of his skull, his spirit will tire and he'll become so sad, then he'll be sitting there. But where? Oh, I wonder. I hope it's somewhere he loves, somewhere with green hills and trout streams, or with mad bustle if that's what he wants. The memory turning back around to race back to him then, zooming, zooming, blasting back through the unseen night, blasting back through the visible day, blasting down through any cloud he might be under, or any roof he might be under, or any tree he might be under, or through the top of his car rolling down the road. The anxiety welling up in him, exams, job search, she hurt me. He made me cry. I wish I was better. I'm so scared of what's next. Everything slamming into his scalp like lightning, like rain, like hot summer sun, and then thrusting him headlong into the past. Back to a day long ago. God, how we forget things. Back when he was laughing beside me, when I was smiling my ass off, him kissing a fish I'd caught, throwing it back into the lake. Standing there, just the two of us, watching the lake swallow its child back into its mysterious belly, a pissed-off red-winged blackbird clacking at us from a pine above the dock. Coffee in my veins, Kool-Aid in his veins, same imperfect blood running so perfectly through our veins. Dad, put a bigger worm on my hook, he tells me. I want to catch a big bass. I don't say anything. I just nod. He runs back to get the rod where he dropped it over by the bench. He runs back and I'm waiting by the plastic container of worms. For a second then, I feel it. Total happiness. It comes and goes, but it came and I felt it, man. Don't tell me. I know what I know. I pick out a fat crawler and Henry's face explodes. Oh yeah, that's the guy. And we both shoot out into the stars again. But someday we'll be back.
So next summer, what kind of fishing are we gonna do?
Saltwater.
What?
Saltwater.
You wanna go saltwater?
Yeah.
I wanted to take you this year at the shore, but you guys didn't want to go. What about muskies?
Maybe Pole Valley. I mean, Lodge for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think you would do if you hooked into a big muskie?
I'll give it to you to fill in, but it's gonna be my fish.
That's not fair. I would stand there and help you.
Like, you would help me fill it in?
Of course. I would stand behind you and make sure you don't get pulled into the lake or the river. We had some good times, huh?
Yeah.
Is we decided to split custody equal, so there is half of the week where you have all the kids and I have no one, and then there's half of the week when I have the kids and you have no one, and either way is equally painful. Like, I was thinking about the other day, like, when I have the kids, it's madness and so difficult, and then the minute I don't have the kids, it's so difficult and awful, and I find myself really by the time I'm ready to hand over custody to you, I find myself sort of like, oh, thank God. Right. And then I take like two breaths of relief, and then I'm sad and alone, and it's horrible.
And the guilt that comes with that, you know, that guilt you get for feeling used relieved. To it. You get used to feeling all these really odd and sometimes horrible things, you know, that, yeah, there is this great sense of relief. I mean, I'm finding, even now, you know, 3.5 years in, our kids are 3, 6, and 8. You know,
good job on getting the ages right.
I have it written on my hand. No. But I'm finding, and I'll admit this, that I don't know if I'm getting better at being a single parent. Like, there are times something comes over me at 6:30 in the evening. I don't think it's unusual, but something comes over me where I just, I feel like I go from...
It's enough.
It's like a Jekyll Hyde thing. Yeah, done. Beyond done. Like psychotic done.
Right,
like,
but that's not a single... That's not exclusive to single parenting. I think...
But it's worse because...
You don't have someone to tap out. I just wanted to mention, this was great. We had we'd asked a question on our Ex-Life Facebook page. What's the hardest part about being alone and parenting kids after a breakup or divorce? And Courtney was very succinct and smart in her answer. She just said, no one to tap out. That's it. When you don't have anyone to tap out, even if it's just for 5 minutes to go scream into a towel in the bathroom, you're just there. And I feel you. That's why I drink so much beer. you will, it's almost impossible to relay the awfulness. And it's your own children, but you literally want to peel your skin off and die because it's so hard.
I'm going whole hog here, like being honest. Maybe because of the position that I was in, and this is something that I struggle with a lot, because of the details of how our separation/divorce unfolded. But I still struggle mightily with this, like, rage. Sometimes toward you, like where I'm so mad
when
I'm like Charlie is pissing his pants and the dishes and the dinner and the clothes and the laundry and the dishes, the fucking dishes, you know, and I and I'm like,
and you get mad at me because I'm not there to do your dishes.
Yeah, no, it's not about.
You feel rage at me for putting you in that position.
And I know it's wrong. Like, I know that's wrong. But it has been a huge part of my life, you know, since the breakup. What are we going to call the breakup? We should have, like, a launching word.
The breakup?
Yeah, like...
The divorce?
Year one or something. I don't know.
I'll just say the divorce, since the divorce.
I hate saying that word over and over again.
All right.
But... I know that may be a foreign element as far as you're concerned, because you, and I think about this. I know it's weird, but like I think about, well, she probably isn't in that position.
Why would I not? But then again, I'm a single person. Oh, to be mad at you?
Yeah, to be mad at me because you sort of instigated
the divorce. This is funny. We have the same goddamn argument, and we can't go down this path. But what you're saying is that you bear no responsibility for our divorce, and because I'm the one that pulled the trigger, the final trigger, it's all my fault, and your rage towards me is justifiable, where I can look at you and be like, listen, motherfucker, you're the reason I pulled the trigger. You fucked up the marriage right there with me. It takes two people to fuck up a marriage, and so just because I was the one that pulled the final trigger and said, I'm out.
Right.
Your rage for me is justifiable. I could have rage for you.
That's what I'm saying.
I can have rage for you for not listening to me and making me finally pull the trigger.
What I'm trying to shine a light on is the fact that I struggle with things in a very real sense, you know, with my own kids, you know, in the middle of a regular Monday evening, you know, in the middle of the winter or whatever. It's just a normal, everyday kind of thing. And it comes into play with me. But, however, the reason I'm bringing it up is because I'm aware of it and I know that it's wrong. And I know that when I feel that, even though I'm not always strong enough to just push it back down, there are times when I'm literally picking all the toys up and they're fighting.
And you're cursing me under your breath?
Yes.
God damn.
Yes. But I'm not blaming you. You see what I'm saying? Like, there's a difference.
Right.
I'm not saying. No. Like, I know it's not your fault, even when I'm doing it.
You're touching on what I touched on a little bit in the last episode, where you have an emotional response to something.
Right.
And you have an intelligent response to something.
Right.
Your emotional response is, that fucking bitch, how could she put me in this position? But your intelligent response understands all of the
So I guess what I'm asking is, does beer help with that kind of thing?
Yeah, beer helps.
No, what I'm really saying is...
It really does help take the edge off. I don't give a shit. I'm going to tell you right now, I advocate smoking a joint, having two beers.
Here we go. Oh. There goes all the dreams we had up
no,
in
I
smoke.
Don't. How is,
Monica and Chong's up in smoke.
How is smoking a joint any different from taking medication?
I wouldn't know. I have never smoked a joint.
Oh, my God. Here we go. No,
that could be a whole nother episode.
Whatever helps you get through the day and take the edge off, as long as you're not abusing shit and you're not waking and baking and going to work high, I don't care. Whatever. Parenting is so fucking hard. And the thing about it is, we've done it to ourselves. Like, parenting, even a few decades ago, something happened where we all started trying to keep up with the Joneses on Instagram and put your kids in gymnastics and this kid is in that and look at my kid and look at his kid and oh my God, that it's this very intense, almost competitive, not almost competitive, it is a competitive thing that I want no part of.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be a parent in the 1970s.
Well, we can't. In a lot of ways, we've set ourselves up perfectly because we can't compete. You know, there's no, I can't compete with an Instagram mom, you know.
But what I'm saying
is,
fuck
a chalkboard in the kitchen and
that Instagram mom.
And the,
that's
and
what
the
I'm saying.
Herb garden
to you.
Growing above the
that's
table.
That's what I'm saying. We shouldn't try to compete, but somehow in the like 90s or the 2000s, what is it? The aughts? That's what they call it now, the aughts, the early aughts. The early aughts.
Mm.
This parenting thing started happening where it was helicopter parenting, and this thing where our moms used to smoke a cigarette or whatever and let the kids run loose. And you see all the articles all over the internet where when I was a kid, I left in the morning and I didn't come home until the streetlights turned on. And is society more dangerous now so we can't let our kids do that? No.
Right.
It's being reported more. There were child molesters in the 60s. There's child molesters now. But parenting has become a fucking national nightmare in America specifically, and we're all a victim of it, but we're all still doing it to each other, and it's bullshit. Like, we've made it so hard that, and not only so hard, but the pressure to do certain things and be a certain way as a parent is fucking bonkers, and I'm sick of it. I don't want any part of that nonsense. So if you do have some sort of inner pressure, especially as a divorced solo dad,
I think...
Fuck that pressure.
Yeah,
it's bullshit.
And I also think that there's a benefit to my particular position at times, because in society's eyes, just showing up...
There's a huge double standard.
Yeah. And I'm aware of that. But that's also man's own making, you know?
Men have set the bar so low as dads that when you actually just show up and do your goddamn job, you're a fucking hero that all the websites write articles about. When you do your daughter's hair, you're amazing.
Right. And I'm not. I mean, I am certainly not.
No, you're not.
Am I better than a lot of dads? Probably, because I have to be, you know?
I don't know. I think I have seen men... fathers substantially up their game in the past few years, just recently, where I feel like the bar is no longer set at if you just show up and do dad work, you're a success or you're an amazing hero. I think you guys are finally getting your shit together enough that the bar, I just see it happening that more men are stay at home dads or becoming more involved just by nature of women going out to work. I see a subtle shift. I do experience a shift, but the double standard is ridiculous. Where I was talking to my friend about this the other day, where if I take my kids to the grocery store and they're whining and complaining, I'll get dirty looks from people like, why don't you control your children? But he takes his son to the grocery store and his son can be a jerk or whatever, and he's trying to parent his kid that's being a jerk, and he gets these sympathetic smiles from people like, good job, dad. And it's just ridiculous.
Right. Well, isn't it funny, if you remember, I mean, I know you remember, the nightmare scenario of going to Walmart or Target with me back in the day.
Are you really going to admit this on
Yeah, I'm going to admit it because I...
This is a large part of our divorce, dude.
I understand.
Like, you're going there?
But here's what's funny. Like, well, I used to... I'll set it up. I used to not be able to handle just normal childhood behavior in public. So... Not all the time. Don't get me wrong.
If one of the kids was having a meltdown at Walmart, Serge would out-meltdown their meltdown. And he would start to breathe heavy and get really stressed.
I would get flustered.
And so, flustered.
I like that word.
Okay, we'll go with flustered. And as a parent, it's stressful enough when your kid has a meltdown and you're trying to deal with it. But when you have a spouse starting to freak out and you have to deal with them to the point where they're like, let's just go. We need to get out of here. It becomes so overwhelming to you that I would shut down. I would just be like, go wait in the car, Serge. Go wait in the car. I've got this. And you would go wait in the car. Or sometimes we would just leave and go home because you did not deal well. I mean, look how far you've come, though.
Well, that's the point I was about to make.
Yes.
Like, I went from being like, you know.
Very high
General
strung.
George Armstrong fluster to now I had to figure it out. Because
right.
when I'm on my own in Walmart, I can't lean on you. I can't lean on someone else. I can't expect someone else to pick up the slack.
Blood leaves, you get some reaction. Sympathy from me, from the people I love. Flowers and cards to salute me. I'm a snowflake, I'm a dove.
Life as a solo parent is a series of rushes. A rush from home to daycare, from daycare to work, work back to daycare, daycare to home, home to Serge's house, his place back to mine. Holy shit, we're out of milk for the third time this week. Get in the car, kids. I feel like I'm always late. I hate being late. Late as a moth flapping in my chest, a hand squeezing my esophagus, a roiling in my stomach, an eventual headache at the end of the day, but just keep going, you. You've got dinner to make, a house to clean, a lawn to mow, bills to pay, work to do, and a list of TV shows waiting to be watched that you try to get to at the end of the day like it's a second job. Some token effort to feel like a part of society before exhaustion tackles you into fitful slumber. Divorced. 40. 40! A toddler. A toddler! I am overwhelmingly aware that these are the days with my children that I should be relishing, especially now that divorce has halved my time with them. My sweet Charlie learning ABCs and making his first real friends. The sensitive little muffin Henry waxing poetic about love and life and the best superhero powers while casually winking, hey, beautiful, to me in a way that makes my heart pound harder than if he were Jake Gyllenhaal himself. Violet telling stories and asking to snuggle and calling me Mama for the last few times before deciding Mom is much more her third grade style. Instead, I am in survival mode, their precious childhood moments ominously ticking away during a post-divorce haze I'm desperately trying to find my way through. When the fuck will I feel better? It feels like a slow-motion divorce while my kids are growing in fast forward. Parenting, when your kids are so young, dominates the entirety of your existence. Parenting alone? Forget about it. The complexity involved in the constant keeping alive of small humans who, if left alone, challenge death at every hazardous turn. Take the ping pong ball out of your mouth. Don't jump from there. Sit down in the tub. You're going to give yourself a concussion. Stop running ahead of me. That car almost hit you. Sit down in the cart. Don't stick things in the outlet. Get out of the road. Don't touch that. It's hot. Put on a jacket. It's cold. Don't hold your brother's head under the water. He can't breathe. And simply keeping them alive isn't good enough. You've saved someone's life 17 times today, and it's not good enough. You have to do more stuff, like brush their teeth and put clothes on them and wipe shit off them and force them into bed every night and then beg them to get up the next morning. I knew this before kids, of course, but much like I imagine experiencing war from the front lines, you can't fully realize the intensity and trauma involved until you're living it. You can read all the books, watch all the movies, and hear all the stories about something, but until it's your reality, you can't really know. You can watch Saving Private Ryan 800 times, but until it's you and the landing craft storming French beaches, you just don't know. And it's not only keeping them alive and relatively clean, but you kind of need to enrich the lives you are saving on a regular basis with quality time and reading. And do you know your alphabet and smiles and can you tie your shoes and I love you so much it's terrifying and here's your chocolate milk and reassurance and unconditional everything. And get in the car, I'm late for work and I'm sorry I made chicken nuggets instead of macaroni and cheese and inspiration and right from wrong. And oh, you wanted lemonade, not chocolate milk. I'm eternally sorry and here's your glass of water. No, I won't buy that for you today. And just one more story and oh God, not that Dr. Seuss one. It takes 20 minutes to get through and I'm so tired and holy shit. Also, that's not enough. You must constantly deal with the ever-present suffocating guilt that you aren't doing all of the above all of the time, and if you are, you're probably doing most of it wrong. They say so. I don't know who they are, but they told me you're doing it wrong, and they probably know because they have 75,000 followers on Instagram. By the way, do you know how easy you have? It's so easy. So many people are worse off than you. You should feel guilty for feeling overwhelmed because there's the thing called privilege, and you have it, so you should feel guilty for not constantly acknowledging your privilege. They told me so. Your overwhelmedness is an offense to those who have it worse. Oh, and savor all of the moments, all of them, because it goes by so fast, and in a blink it's gone. And look, Mom, watch me, Mom. Savor it all, and if you aren't savoring, feel guilty as hell about that, too, because you love your kids more than anything. Sometimes you just gawp at them, and the magnificence of their being is so overwhelming you start to cry because you can't fathom that they are yours and you are theirs forever. And of course, you would die for them in 3 seconds, but also, can you just get a moment to yourself because you are tired as fuck, but your beautiful 6-year-old boy is asking you to play superheroes? And how hard is that, you selfish bitch? Get off your ass and make the smashing, crashing noises he likes. He's not going to be this magical age forever, and in 10 years you'll give anything for him to ask you to play. Who has time for savoring when barely surviving? Dog paddling in the ocean, that's what it always feels like. Paddling like a son of a bitch to stay above water, tired as fuck, too many thoughts, too much alcohol in an attempt to mute the thoughts that become louder anyway. Constantly wondering what constitutes too much alcohol, wondering if wondering about what constitutes too much alcohol is my answer. I do this thing a lot where I think about myself in my 50s and I'll look back at me now at 40, just like me now looks back at me in my 20s with a kindness and compassion I can't ever seem to muster for myself in the present moment. And I'll be like, ah, I remember going through that. Fuck. You feel fucking awful right now, don't you? I know. But we got through. I wish I could come back and tell you this thing and that thing and don't waste so much time worrying about that other thing because I know exactly how you're feeling. But girl, you're gonna be fine. This is the trenches. We were in the trenches, but it's better now. And look at all that you learned. Or fuck. Maybe life will be so much shittier then that I'll look fondly back on this time as the good years. But even if these years that feel so intense end up being the good years, I always think about this comedic bit from someone about what you get with a basic life. And it keeps it all in perspective. We get to be on Earth. I mean, look at this place. We get to eat. Every time I eat a burrito, I think about that. Like, shit, I'm in debt, or my job sucks, or that relationship was lame. But how bad is all this really when I'm eating this fucking burrito and I'm going to sleep shortly thereafter in a warm bed and I can look at porn and masturbate? I can masturbate. That alone is pretty miraculous, no? I can make myself come. I know how. And I'm not embarrassed to tell you about it, even though maybe you're embarrassed to hear about it. Unclench your butthole and get over it, Uncle Byron. I also get to read heart-wrenchingly beautiful books and listen to music that vibrates my soul. Sex with other people is also part of the basic life package. We get to fuck. I'm getting older and wiser, and in case anyone is wondering, fucking is way better when you're older. I want to do an It Gets Better video for girls in their 20s enduring shitty sex for various reasons, but mostly because they just don't know any better. If you're lucky enough for all your physical and mental shit to align in just the right way, you can really have a good time in your 30s and beyond. In stark contrast to the overwrought sexual relationship body drama of your 20s, you've maybe learned a ton about sex and relationships and are fucking the right people for the right reasons while giving less of a flying fuck about bullshit body issues. And if you're really lucky, you never lose that, oh my God, I'm fucking another person feeling from your teens and 20s. It can all come together in a really excellent way is what I'm saying. So there's that, talking to you about fucking. But whatever, we're all grown-ups here. Quit being such a prude. I'm just trying to tell you that when I get the too busy blues, I like to remember how lucky I feel to be participating in the basic life package, which is pretty much the greatest stuff ever. Earth and food and music and books and fucking. And dogs. Dogs save lives. You should get one. And Father Time can do your best to mend a broken heart. That's the thing with being a divorced parent that shares custody, is the feelings are so jacked all over the place, where you're so overwhelmed when you have the kids and there's no one to tap out. And there's also no one to share the beautiful moments with, as a bunch of people on Facebook noted.
That's what I was.
You can't exchange that knowing smile when your kid does something funny.
Right.
Although, luckily for you and I, like, I'll text you funny things that Henry said, and texting kind of helps, or you'll send me photos or whatever. But you're either super overwhelmed and you're freaking out and losing your mind, or you're completely blue and alone because they've already left you, or you have that moment of relief that they've left you, but that's also followed by the guilt that you feel relief. It's all so many emotions and horribleness as a parent that, you know, it's just an overwhelming addition to just regular parenting, right. I think. I don't know.
I often, because I guess what I was asking you, like, I often find myself trying to think about what they're doing at your house at any given moment. And often that occurs, you know, when the busy day is winding down.
I do that a lot, yeah.
And you know how it is when they, when they're done a bath, you know, and their hair smells like fresh shampoo, and they maybe want a snack before they're going to watch some Netflix or something. And just these little tiny things that occur that most parents, you know, unless they're really, really on top of, like, soaking in every moment, to use one of those cliches. Or
platitude.
Yeah. Like, most parents probably lose sight of that when they're together with the other parent. You know, if it's two people handling it all. And going back to my, you know, kind of opening thoughts about how I lose my shit a lot of time in the evening. And when, even when they're here with me, I feel like the shampoo doesn't smell as sweet sometimes because I'm so tired and I'm so exhausted.
You can't appreciate the nice moments.
Yeah, and it's this kind of feast or famine thing where they're with me and I should be feasting on it. And don't get me wrong, I do. Like, those are the days that are the most important days in my life and always will be. And I don't even know what I'm going to do if I live long enough to where they're all not here anymore and they live somewhere else. Because in so many ways, this three-on-one thing that's going to be going on for the next 15 years, you know, until Charlie's out of high school or whatever, that is going to be so embedded in who I am that letting go of that is probably going to be even harder.
That's every parent, though. That's the empty nest syndrome.
But so these nights when they're not with me, you know, I struggle when they're here. And I struggle when they're not here in these different ways, in these various ways. And I'm just wondering, like, do you, because I think sometimes I don't know how to occupy myself. Sometimes in the wintertime, I'm a mess. Like, I end up going to bed when they're not here, even at, I'm not lying. Like, sometimes I'll go to bed at 7:30, you know, I'll get in bed with a book or whatever, because I don't even know what to do with myself, you know? And it's a very strange phenomenon. And I have no excuse. I know people will be like, what an idiot. You know, you have this free time.
Get a hobby.
Yeah. And, but sometimes I feel almost crippled, and I'm not tooting my own freaking dad horn here. I'm not. I'm just presenting it as this idea that I wonder if you or other people experience sometimes, where it doesn't just go away. I'm getting more used to it. I find that I'm getting better at being just a human being again. But I often still feel inhuman, you know, when they're here and often when they're not. I feel lost, for lack of a better word, I suppose.
Yeah, I find it's all a muddled mess because when they're with me, like you said, I want to appreciate the moments and be able to sit back and appreciate them and be able to tap out and sort of float above it all and be like, look at my beautiful family. But you're so in it and give me my hot or my chocolate milk and my dinner and this, and then it's bath time, that you don't even have time to take that nice moment in. And then when they're gone, you feel empty and blue. And another thing that I find happening to me when they're gone with you is I immediately start going through all the horrible things I said to them not that I say a ton of horrible things, but I'll think back, oh, do you remember when Henry was trying to get me to read a story with him and I didn't have time because I was giving Charlie a bath? And I was so shitty to Henry, and I should have stopped what I was doing and sat down and read the book with Henry, but I had to get through the stuff. And, and I start thinking of all the ways I blew them off when they were with me, and I feel terrible, and to the point where I'm like paralyzed with sadness that I'm a shitty mother.
Right. But you know what? Honestly, this is the truth. I'm going to drop a truth bomb in your lap right now.
Right.
Girl.
Okay.
They're never going to see it that way. When they look back on all this, and that's, I tell myself that, and I don't think I'm lying to myself, and I can tell you that too, and I don't think I'm lying to you. They're not. They're going to look back on both of us, and they're going to be like, that was the most magnificent childhood.
You think?
I do. I really do. I think that. I believe it. I believe that they're going to look back on us just like most kids whose parents are present and trying their best. They're not going to say, man, mom, you didn't get down on the floor and play enough with us. Or, man, dad, you didn't read us enough bedtime stories, even though you claim to love books so much. You were always so tired and your eyeballs were popping out of your freaking head at the end of the day. And you ran out of that room as soon as you got us set up with Netflix as quickly as you could so you could go and watch your own Netflix and eat whatever crap food you were eating. You know, I think they're going to look at it like, man, thank you. Peace out.
Is that your mic drop?
If I drop it, it's going to make a fuss.
That's the point of a mic drop, I think.
I just wanted to say I think you're doing a good job. I think I'm doing a better job, but you're... I think you're doing okay.
Okay, I appreciate that.
To find food and listen for danger. Around 6 weeks old, hoglets leave their mothers. Hoglets build their own nests.
I like that word, hoglets.